And so one would have to ask you, what is your life story? Maybe nobody ever asks you that, but when I meet people, I steer the conversation as quickly as possible. I steer the conversation to discover or unwrap or uncover their story. And I want to know four things: who they are, where they are from, that's their physicalness, their roots, what country, what ethnic group, what language group. I want to know where they have been, that's their life experiences. And I also like to know where they are going, what are their dreams, what are their goals, what direction are they heading. In other words, I want to understand what matters to them as a person, as a human being. And if you start asking those kinds of questions with people, because people love to talk about themselves, you will hear some neat stories. So I had a very long Tuesday flying out of Montreal to Calgary and then coming back into Regina. And from Calgary to Regina, I had a seatmate. The other flights, I had three seats beside me empty. And on this last flight from Calgary in to Regina, I sat next to a retired nurse. This retired nurse had just gone out to a reunion in Victoria, and they had everybody but seven of the 69 students that had graduated together. She worked at the Regina General, although now she's retired. She lives in Fort Qu'Appelle area. Her husband has some health problems, but he was driving in to pick her up, and they were going to drive back the next day for his tests. She had a picture that she was carrying that was too big to fit in the overhead bin of all the nurses that were there together, and so we looked at that for a while. She's not religious. Her dad was a Mormon, died a Mormon, and had a Mormon funeral, but her idea is that everybody should get it together, every church, every system, every understanding, every theology, every belief could all come together and just, you know, be one.
One.
Yeah.
Unitarian.
So when you begin to talk to people about these four things, you are actually catching an emotional connecting point. And that's what you're looking for with people. And the death of her dad, who was a Mormon, and the funeral service for him many years ago, was her emotional connecting point. The emotional connecting point bridges the gap between you and them. Up till then, it's just information. But when you're asking these four questions, you're looking for the emotional click. Something turns the light on, and then it opens the door to sharing the gospel of the kingdom. Because Jesus said in Matthew 24:14 that the gospel of the kingdom would go to every nation before he could come back. So literally, every person I meet, I am looking to create an emotional connecting point. But it's up to them, because only they can open the door. But you have to be aware of that's what you're looking for, and aware of it when it comes. So you're asking people to tell you their story. And everybody loves a good story. That's why we watch movies. They're telling a story. Or we read books because they're telling a story. Or we watch the television series that goes on for 8 years because it's telling a continuing story. And if you notice, the half hour or hour long television shows are now all giving you the thing that's going to take them to the next one and the next one. Where at one time they used to all stand alone, now you have to watch the whole series because the story continues. Stories are how we relate to one another, how we learn from one another, and how we remember things. And so we need to watch for people's stories. In fact, even in sermons and teachings overseas, they don't remember the raw details. They remember the stories. They don't care about cold facts and statistics. They remember the stories. They want excitement. They want drama. They care about pictures. They want to laugh. And they want to see and feel what happened when you tell the story. And the nice thing about traveling, you have lots of stories you can tell. Because you're not with the same people who were there for the story. Which would be boring. Jesus told stories.
Yes, he did.
And Jesus had these emotional connecting points with people because he would ask them about their story. So we're going to ask you again, what's your story? There's a reason I'm asking. Because we don't think about it very often, our own story. We all have a story up to this point in our lives. And we need to kind of sort through what kind of a story it is. Because every one of our stories can have a bit of humor, can have some drama. We can have some ups and downs, some wins and losses. There can be a bit of comedy, a bit of tragedy, a bit of history. It's inside all of us, but we have to learn how to tell our story in a way that other people would find it
interesting
and won't shut off. Okay, but overall, each of our lives tells a larger story. The Bible will call that a testimony. So when I say, what's your story? In some ways, we could say, what's your testimony? Mm-hmm. Because Revelation 12:11 says, you overcome the work of the devil by the blood of the Lamb, the word of your testimony, and you do not love your life even unto death. In other words, you're self-abandoned. So you have a salvation story. For most of us, that was a long time ago, like 40 years plus. But you also should have a God story, what he's currently doing in that right now, in you, through you, with you. So let me ask all of that a whole nother way. When it's all over, what is it that you want your life to say? I think most people would like to think that their life had some significance. Mm-hmm. So what is it you want to be remembered for, other than the fact you came from Ireland? Listen, every person you talk to wants their story to be of significance. No one wants to feel like the world would not miss them if they had never lived. No one should live their life in such a way that when they die, the world is no better off than if they had never been born. Now, I got a neat story. And it's about these two companies. The two companies are Apple Computers, founded by Steve Jobs, and his work at trying to get John Sculley to come and work for him. And John Sculley was the CEO of PepsiCo, which is the mother company of Pepsi. At the time, Apple Computers were just beginning, and Steve Jobs was working out of his garage, and John Sculley happened to be a multimillionaire who has led Pepsi-Cola around the world to become the most famous soft drink in the world, even better than Coca-Cola. Pepsi was one of the largest and most successful companies in the world at the time that this little story is happening. So Steve Jobs came to John Sculley numerous times. They discussed numerous times the possibility that John Sculley would come over to Apple Computers and work for Steve Jobs. And the answer in these numerous discussions they had was no, period. Then one day, Steve Jobs said to the CEO of Pepsi, do you want to see sugar water for the rest of your life? Or do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life? Or do you want to come with me and change the world?
Did nothing change up there?
No, it wasn't supposed to.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come with me and change the world? In other words, the question was, do you want your life to have some significance? And it was that day that Steve Sculley left Pepsi and joined young Steve Jobs in his garage working on Apple Computers, and 30 years later eventually took over Steve Jobs' job. Do you believe that your life can have significance? do you believe that you can live a life of significance? Or are you just living life and sucking it up? So never mind looking at what has happened in the past or what has not happened so far. Don't look at your current situation, emotional, physical, relational. From today on, tonight on, do you believe that you can live a life of significance? That you can do something with your life that really matters. That you could impact your world. As big or as small as your world is, or as big or as small as your impact might be, that you could impact your world. In other words, if you were writing your story, could you make your story great? See, now I believe that you could, and you will, if you make some needed changes. And many times we just let life happen to us instead of grabbing hold of life and making it happen with us. So if you want to make a difference in the world, if you want to live a life of significance, if you want to be significant, all you have to do is make a difference with others wherever you are, with whatever you have. Too often we sit back and say, well, if I had this, and if I lived there, and if I had this education, and if I could influence this group, and if I had some sort of connection over here, that's not the way you do it. To live a life of significance, to be significant in the kingdom, all you have to do is make a difference with others wherever you are and with whatever you have. And do it every day, day by day, day after day, as you live life. That's not hard. The secret to living a life that is making a difference, and thus a life that is significant, is living each day with intentionality. That's a key word. When you live each day with intentionality, there's no limit to what you can do. When you intentionally use your everyday life to bring about positive change in the lives of others, you will live a life that matters. So I'm going to tell you a story. It's a true story. And I called it, "It Started with a Small Thing, with a Small Idea." That's my title for it. There's a young woman. Her name was Carrie Rich. And she was in her 20s. And she was working as a senior director for Inova Health Systems in Virginia, USA. And one day she got an idea. She wanted to do something positive for others. So she thought that with a small amount of money, she could get others to contribute to organizations that were already making a difference. That she would be like an unofficial fundraiser for certain ministries, certain charities that were already doing something that was making a difference. So she got excited about the idea. She went to her boss, his name is Knox, who had been CEO of the company for 30 years. She'd always worked for him. And she explained her idea, and his response was, "That's nice, Carrie. Now would you go back to work, please?" 2 months later, for her birthday, Knox gave her a card, and in it were two things, $100 and a quote by John Wesley. "Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can."
Who did the quote?
John Wesley.
That's a really good one.
Carrie says that Knox had taken the lunch money that he would have spent taking her out for lunch on her birthday and given it to her as a gift for her to use for her good causes that she was working on. So what would she do? She decided that she would turn the $100 into $1,000, and she'd do that 6 times so that she could help 6 different organizations with $1,000 each. So she had to raise $6,000. Now, I don't know about you, but I called this, it all starts with a small idea, because in today's world where Bill and Melinda Gates have given away $28 billion, $6,000 sounds rather trivial. But that didn't discourage Carrie. She wrote to organizations in Washington, D.C., Haiti, and Tanzania, and a few other places to ask what they would do if she gave them $1,000. The Washington, D.C. area organization said it would improve literacy rates for a class of students. The Haitian organization said it would sustain 10 families by using community agriculture. Tanzanian organization would send 25 women through secondary school, all for $1,000 each. So she was ready to act. She had some good causes. She'd do something that she hoped would be significant, but how would she turn $100 into $6,000? So she decided to do something she'd never done before. She wrote individual email requests to every family and every family member and every friend. Ultimately, to every name that came up out of her contact list, even if she didn't remember who they were. She started alphabetically at A and went to Z. The problem was that emails have this subject line, and she didn't know what to write on the subject field on the email. And so she thought about it for a long time, actually, and she could come up with nothing better, so she decided on the name The Global Good Fund. So she put it up on Facebook, and she sent these emails to everybody. And before long, money started coming in, $20, $50, $100, $1,000. And here's her words. It was extraordinarily generous, particularly from my peers who were just starting in the workplace. This whole thing resonated with them. Within 2 weeks, she'd raised $6,000. And $52. She felt good. She'd started small. She had accomplished her goal. She was ready to give the money to the 6 organizations. All done, she thought. Little could she guess what would happen next. As the donations were coming in, she had received an email from someone she had met for 5 minutes at a conference a year earlier. They had exchanged business cards that day, and when Carrie got home to her office, she had sent him a nice to meet you email as a follow-up. So his name appears on her contact lists. So he got one of the letters. The return email from the man, who wanted to remain anonymous, said, "I'd like to donate $1 million to the Global Good Fund. Where should I send the check?" And her reaction was, "This guy's pranking me. I'm not giving him my home address." So she emailed him back saying that if he was serious, it was to meet her on a particular day at a specific time in a specific place, a very public place with cameras, security cameras. And she would wait only 10 minutes. When he arrived, he handed her a bank-certified check for $1 million. Made out to the Global Good Fund, an organization that did not exist. His question for Carrie was the same one she had asked the 6 original organizations she decided to help. What will you do with the money? And Carrie was not prepared for such a question because honestly, she didn't think the guy would even show up. So she couldn't fathom somebody she had just met for 5 minutes giving her $1 million. So she quickly thought about what had made a difference in her life, and she told him that she would invest in young leaders around the world who were using entrepreneurship for social impact. As others had invested in her, she would help these young leaders to grow personally so they could be a gift to society. He handed her the check. Not knowing what to do, Carrie went back to the office and asked to see her boss, Knox. His assistant, Carol, could see that Carrie was sweating and hyperventilating, so she escorted her right in. "Look what you have done," Carrie said, slamming the $1 million check down on her boss's desk. "You gave me the lunch money, and this stranger gave me $1 million for an organization that doesn't even exist. I have no idea what to do with the money. Would you please help me?" And Knox replied, "I'll help you under two conditions. First, while you may report to me at work, I'd like to volunteer and report to you at Global Good Food Fund. Secondly, I'm going to match that anonymous gift."
Holy crap.
And Carrie said, "You know that expression, you fell out of your chair? I literally did." Carol came in and helped me back up, and that's how it all started. That was the year 2011. A year later, Carrie stopped working for Inova, became the CEO of Global Good Fund, which she created as a nonprofit organization. And she was true to her word. She began a fellowship program that is already investing in 19 young leaders in 19 countries around the world. And she's continuing to look for opportunities to make a difference. So she has a life that is significant. Mm-hmm. Yes. How big will the Global Good Fund become? Who knows? How much impact will it make? Who knows? Who cares? She decided to do something that might be significant. And no one knows how significant. She's still very young. She's making a difference now. She's helping people, making the world a better place. So it's not doesn't matter how big the impact, it's who are you impacting? Who are you helping to make progress in their life, to bring come forward? So the secret to living a life that is making a difference, a life that therefore would be significant, is living each day with intentionality. And if you do that, there's no limit to what you can do. When you intentionally use your everyday life to bring about positive change in the life of others, you begin to live a life that matters. Now, your story is not as meaningful, if your story is not as meaningful or significant or compelling as you want it to be, you can change it. And only you can change it. You can begin by writing a whole new story today. So stop listening to the stories other people are telling you, who have made a difference, who are significant in their life. I mean, I got shelf loads of books upstairs of those kinds of people, all of which I've read. Decide instead that you're going to have a story of significance and that you're going to be the central character in your story. So how do you start? You need a change in the mindset from passive to active. Most people let life happen to them, instead of making life happen with them. Life doesn't just happen to you. You should be determining the direction of your life and the depth of your life and the breadth of your life, especially in this country. Now, if you came from Turkmenistan, you probably don't have a lot of choices in front of you. But we come from a heck of a good country with a lot of choices in front of us, and all we have to do is learn to approach life differently. So there's only 4 points. Number one, put yourself in your story. You don't stumble into significance. You don't passively float into living your life in a way that will make a difference.
Sorry, put yourself
in the story. It should say that. Oh, you have to start. Sorry. If you just stumble along, you won't be in your story. You'll never start. And you just don't float into anything of significance. So there's this picture of a race. If I got it. Oh, there you go. That's what should have come up. Hebrews 12:1. Let us run the race that is set before us. There's no race. The race is your life. And so you have to start the race. And you have to be intentional about making your life matter. That calls for actions, not excuses. It's easier to go from failure to success than it is from excuses to success. It's easier to go from failure to success than from excuses to success. Successful people who made a significant difference for others, there are a lot of them. Let me give you some of the people I've read. Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, Helen Keller, Winston Churchill. If you haven't seen the movie about World War II and Winston Churchill, that's out, it's excellent.
Is it?
Awesome. It's more than excellent. Albert Schweitzer, Gandhi, Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud. They did a list of the 300 most significant people in the last so many years. All of them could have had excuses. Three-quarters of that 300 people, as children, were troubled by poverty, a broken home, dysfunctional parents who rejected them or controlled them.
Winston Churchill had a debilitating stutter?
Yes. 74 out of the 85 top writers of fiction or drama, 16 of the 20 top poets, came from homes where children saw psychological drama played out daily by their parents. Over a quarter of these people suffered physical handicaps such as blindness, deafness, or crippled limbs. It's not easy to go from excuses to successes. But if you will do something, anything, even if you fail, it's easier to go from failure to a success. And we have so many excuses. And the people who we think are amazing, who have such tremendous stories, who made such a significant difference to us on our planet, all of them came from dysfunctional families or issues that they could have used as excuses to do diddly squat. So you need to put yourself in your story, start a new race, even if it means being in over your head and that you might fail. T.S. Eliot said, if you aren't in over your head, how do you know how tall you are? I like that one. Steve Jobs, founder of Apple Computers, said, here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently, because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. Mm-hmm. So we need to start. Start with yourself. Someone say amen.
Amen.
Me, me, me. Start with yourself. Your best story begins when you put yourself back into the story and stop living passively and stop enjoying all these other stories around you and become the story. Stop looking. Start living. Number two. Oh, by the way, in the midst of doing all of this, I'm reading a book and in the middle of the book on an airplane, which I bought because I... Coming home from Montreal, I packed the book I was going to read in my suitcase and brought the book I'd finished.
Oh, no.
So in the airport, I bought another book. And in the middle of this book, which I've almost finished, it said, experiment, experience, explore. And I thought, like that. That's exactly what we all need to be doing. Experience, experiment, explore. It doesn't matter what order you take them in. Put yourself into your story. So go experiment. Go explore. Go experience. All right. Secondly, put significance in your story. Stop settling for ho-hum. That goes with coffee, mate, not with life. Now, here's the biggest truth I'm going to give you tonight. Make it simple, but significant. It doesn't have to be complicated. Let me read you a story. Lots of stories. The graveyard shift was the perfect name for it. The middle of the night in the back IT office of the company that Jack Costner worked for was usually as lifeless as they come at the midnight hour. Dark, still, quiet, and boring. And this night was no different. Nothing was moving in that dimly lit, silent room, not even the computer screen that Jack was watching to see if anybody would hack the network he had just installed. Hours had gone by, and he was still just watching and waiting and seeing nothing, knowing all the while that he probably never would. The quiet office was the perfect environment for anyone who has a lot of pain in their lives to be forced to deal with it. Voices have a way of speaking out when there's nothing to fill the void. So Jack thought of his crystal meth addiction that had got him kicked out of the Navy and led to his dad disowning him. He thought about his life and his future, and nothing looked particularly exciting. His mind then drifted to the previous Sunday when he had taken his live-in girlfriend to church because she'd asked him to, and he started to recall the movie clips from The Passion of the Christ that the pastor had shown during the sermon. Surprisingly, the images began to hit him harder in the dead silence of that IT office at midnight than they did when he was sitting in the church. He didn't believe in Jesus. At least, he didn't think he did. But for a brief moment, the man on the cross in the movie had looked like he just might be an answer, possibly the answer, to Jack's life. And so, with the stillness of the room feeling like an opportunity, he walked over to the lone lamp, switched it off, and in the darkness got on his knees. "God, if you're there," he said, "I really want to know. And if you can reveal yourself to me, I will give you my life. I want to give you my life." Jack waited for the thunderclap of some sort. It never came. When he got off his knees and turned the lamp back on, he rubbed his hands over his body and face to see if he felt different. He didn't. At least nothing weird happened, he thought. He walked the sterile aisle, fluorescent-lit hallway to the vending machine to feed his unrelenting smoking habit. And as he stood looking at the cigarettes, a voice suddenly spoke within his spirit. "You're not going to be needing those anymore," it said. Jack stopped. The whole world seemed to stop. And the only inner voice he'd ever experienced with respect to his vices were prompting him to do it, to indulge, to push ahead. This time, however, was a prompting not just to stop, but one that declared him free. He turned around, returned to his office without the cigarettes, and with a strange sense that he would be walking that hallway again. When his shift was up, he walked into the morning light, and like an ex-smoker gets back his taste buds, it was as if his senses were turned back on. The day looked brighter than he'd ever noticed before. The sky looked a new shade of blue. The singing birds were particularly loud and beautiful. "What's this?" he thought. Strangest of all, it had been 4 hours since the incident at the vending machine, and he still had no craving for a cigarette. He never would again. It was this clear and sudden death of his crushing addiction that shook him the most. He knew that everything was now different. God, just like he asked him to, had revealed himself. So Jack aggressively went into discovery mode. He wanted to learn everything he could about this God, and the more he found out, the more he fell in love with Jesus. Jack's heart sang like the songbirds. Soon after, Chris, his co-worker from another department, asked if Jack might go to his house and help him with his slow-going computer. Jack agreed. On the drive over, Jack's eyes suddenly widened when he received another prompting. "I want you to tell Chris about me," the voice said in his spirit. Jack recognized it as the same voice that spoke to him at the vending machine. "I'm not going to do that," he spoke aloud in his car. "That would just make things really weird." Drove the rest of the way just hoping the voice or God wouldn't press the issue. When Jack arrived and took apart Chris's computer, he saw that a virus scan was in order. It would take an hour to complete. As Chris pulled up a chair and sat beside him to wait and watch the screen, Jack gulped. What was he going to do now? What was he going to tell him? The inner voice said. Sorry. What are you going to tell him? The inner voice said. Jack closed his eyes and prayed. "I'll open my mouth. Whatever comes out, you own. Not my fault. Okay, Lord?" When he got home, he was flying high. The conversation had gone smoothly. He loved how it felt to be used by God to speak about him boldly. Better yet was what Chris said to him. "Thanks for what you did today, Jack. No problem. I hope your computer continues to work for you, Jack replied. No, I meant telling me about Jesus. It didn't take long to realize what God was asking him to do. The Jesus Geeks ministry began with Jack and his girlfriend, who has since become his wife, advertising his service in the church bulletin and online community bulletin boards, and then going to responders' homes to fix their computers, tell them about Jesus, and pray. He now has, by the way, a nationwide network of company people working for him. Again, it doesn't have to start big, but you have to do something that gets it started and put some significance into your story. And that's what he did. By the way, the article was Geeky Evangelism. So, to put significance into your story, you have to do something outside your comfort zone. Because obviously you're living in your comfort zone and nothing's happening of any significance. To put significance into your story, you must make changes that you may find difficult. To put significance in your story, you will have to take action. Being passive feels really safe, but if you do nothing, nothing can go wrong, right? No. To put significance in your story, you need to stop waiting, stop hoping, and stop wishing, and start acting. Gee, I wish I could do something. Gee, I hope it happens soon. It never will. You have to start doing something. Okay, and to put significance in your story, you cannot allow your fears and your questions to keep you from starting. Listen, when you get out of your comfort zone and you go to do something for the first time, you're not going to do it well. Because you just did it for the first time. Ernest Hemingway, everybody know Ernest Hemingway?
Yep.
He said, the first draft is always crap. Well, he didn't use the word crap. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he said, the first draft is always crap. So when you start something new to be significant, you're not going to succeed at it. It's going to be crap, probably. But our tendency is to sit back and wait till we know we can do it well and properly before we do anything, and then we never do anything.
Right?
So just jump in. Check for the water later. Number three, put your strength in your story. If you want your life to count and do something significant that will change you and benefit others, there are three questions you need to ask yourself. Can you be the best in the world at what you do? In other words, what talent do you have that would make you the best? Can you be the best in the world at what you do? If you paint, can you be the best painter? And if you're not aiming for the top, you're aiming too low, because we have God helping us. Second question is, what are you passionate about? Are you passionate about what you're doing or what you're planning to do? That's a heart question. If you're not passionate, it's going to be pretty yuck.
Such a philosophical word.
Yeah, I couldn't think of a better word. It's going to be yuck. And the third question is, do you have the resources to change your world? That's just tools and skills. That's all. So play from your strengths and then put your strengths into your story. So if your strengths are selling things, if your strength is painting something and selling that, if your strength is telling a story, play to your strengths, because you focus too much on your weaknesses and what you're missing. And then number four, and probably the most important, stop trying, start doing. When you say, I'll try my best, what you're really saying is, I'll work at having the right attitude, and I'll work at the task, but I won't take responsibility for the outcome. When you say, I'll try, you're not taking responsibility. Can you move forward from where you are by just trying? No, you never will. You need to move beyond the attitude of trying and pick up the attitude of doing. And you'd be amazing. As soon as you decide to do something, how much strength, energy, power, even from God, God gets involved when you step out and begin to do something. As long as you're sitting thinking about it or trying to do it, there's nothing behind you. Amen? Okay, if you're willing to do something, that will lead to a life of significance. And you're responsible for all of that. So, how to start? This is moving from good intentions to intentional living. We all have good intentions that go absolutely nowhere. And when you're dead, everybody will say, oh, they were had so many good intentions. You need to change your mindset from passive to active. I'm repeating myself. This was said earlier. Life does happen to you, but you determine the direction and the depth of that life. And you need to understand that you will need to approach your life differently. And there are only 4 points. Put yourself in the story. Put some significance into that story. Put your strength into your story. And stop trying and start just doing it. You don't finish the race by accident.
If you run in the right direction.
Hebrews 12. Oh, sorry, that's just a repeat. I went too fast for you. Mm-hmm. Hebrews 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight. So you have to do something. You have to be active. Put aside the things that are keeping you back. And every sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance. You don't start unless you're planning to go long distance, the race that is set before us. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. The race is your life. Your life is your story. And it's the greatest story you have to tell. And we're so busy telling other people's stories that we read or hear or see, or instead of telling our own story. So let's read that one in the Message version. Do you see what this means? All these pioneers who blaze the way, all these veterans cheering us on, it means we better get on with it. Strip down, start running, never quit. No extra spiritual fat, no parasitic sins. Keep your eyes on Jesus, who both began and finished this race we're in. Study how he did it, because he never lost sight of where he was headed, that exhilarating finish in and with God. He could put up with anything along the way, cross, shame, whatever. And now he's there in the place of honor, right alongside God. When you find yourself flagging in your faith, go over that story again, item by item, that long litany of hostility he plowed through. That will shoot adrenaline into your souls. Maybe that's what we all need, a shot of adrenaline. So most people don't ever run the race. They have the greatest story never told. You and I, we're supposed to have the greatest story. Your story. And God should be doing something every day. Like speaking to someone at the cigarette machine. Or saying to a young girl in her 20s, raise some money and give it away. Those were just ordinary people who had pretty boring, ordinary jobs. and God got involved. We're ordinary people and God's already involved. So what are you doing, what are you going to be doing, that will be significant and add value to other people?